I'm Mike, and you are listening to the Hardtack Military History Podcast. Hardtack is a military history podcast and contains mature themes, content, and some crude language. Listener discretion is advised. The opinions and analysis expressed are that of the producer. Now, put on your Kevlar. Secure your Lickies and Chewies, and prepare to take cover for this episode of Hardtack. Hello and welcome to Hardtack episode 34, Go for Broke part 2. Where we will resume our interview with the president and CEO of the Go for Broke National Education Center, Dr. Mitch Mackey. If you are tuning into Hardtack for the first time, or if you are returning after a hiatus, go ahead and stop this episode now and first listen to episode 33. That'll help ensure that you get the full story of Go for Broke and the 100th and 442nd. All right, a few things before we get started. Check out the Hardtack socials found via Linktree in the episode description or searching Hardtack on Instagram and Facebook. You can also visit the website, leave a comment, and check out some other content at hardtackpod.com. Please leave us a review on whichever platform you use to consume your Hardtack and subscribe. Ratings and reviews help boost up the show's visibility and expose it to more listeners. If you're interested in contributing to any of the production, you can check out the Hardtack Patreon by searching Hardtack Podcasts on the website or the app. Alternatively, you can contribute directly through our host site, Spotify for Podcasters, previously known as Anchor.fm. All right, that does it. Let's get back into our interview with Dr. Mitch Mackey. Outside of the Go for Broke Monument, we also have the Courage and Compassion exhibition, which I believe is a traveling exhibition, if that's correct. And on the website, I think it showed it was moving. Was it Tennessee that it's moving to next?
We're going to Idaho.
Idaho, that's what it is. Yeah. All right. So what is the Courage and Compassion exhibition? And outside of Idaho, where else is it going and how often does it move?
Well, the Courage and Compassion exhibition is a traveling exhibition that tells the story of the Japanese American experience to various communities. But the hook here is that in the last maybe 20% of the exhibition, it also talks about how that local community stood up and helped Japanese Americans during World War II. So often we hear of all the negativity of that time. And certainly there was a great deal of that, you know, a great deal of racism, a great deal of wartime hysteria, a great deal of ignorance of just not knowing who these Japanese Americans were. But there are also some incredible stories of courage and compassion on the part of the local residents. We've gone to about 15 different cities already, places like Monterey, California, Overland, Ohio, Rochester, Minnesota, Texas. We've been to two places in Texas, and we've been to Oregon and so forth. So the next place we're going is to Idaho. And people might say, well, why Idaho? What's the draw there? First of all, one of the CAMs, Minidoka War Relocation Center, was in Idaho.
Okay.
And surprisingly, there are stories of Japanese American families who were living in Idaho or who moved to Idaho shortly after the war began so that they wouldn't have to go to camp. And amongst these are young men who actually went off and served in the 100th, 442nd, or in the military intelligence service. And one of them, William Nakamura, who was originally from Seattle, was a Medal of Honor recipient, and he and his family relocated to Idaho, and then he went off to war and was killed in action, but then was given the Medal of Honor in recognition of his service. There are some very heartwarming stories also of how the local community supported Japanese Americans once they got to know them. In Los Angeles now, we currently have a veteran named Ed Nakamura. Well, Ed was a high schooler during World War II, and he went off to high school, and he actually became a basketball star at his high school in Idaho when he was in his, I believe, his sophomore year and so forth. By his senior year, he was drafted, and he had to go off to basic training and so forth. And as he was leaving Idaho at the train station, the band from his high school came to the train station to serenade him, because his fellow students, who were white Americans who didn't know Japanese Americans prior to this, had gotten to know him as an individual, had embraced him as an individual. And there's some funny stories about how years later he'll run into people who say, "My father knows you from Idaho," because they remember the Japanese American kid who was the star on their basketball team. Again, a very heartwarming story of how the band came out to serenade him as he left for basic training. I jokingly tell my staff that, the fact that we call this courage and compassion, the fact that we talk about how Americans of all backgrounds did stand up at times to do the right thing in a time of crisis, is a sign of growth in our nation, and it's a sign of growth in the Japanese American community. I tell my staff that if we had had this traveling exhibit 30 years ago, when we were full of piss and vinegar, and we were still very upset about what happened, it would have been, "Look how you screwed us," kind of thing. Versus now, it's important for all of us to say, "Yeah, it was a bad time. Yeah, things happened that we regret. Yeah, we don't ever want to commit those mistakes again." But even in that time, Americans understood constitutionality. Americans understood what it meant to be an American. And there are numerous stories of Americans of all backgrounds standing up for what they believed was right. And that means supporting the Japanese Americans in their communities at that time.
Absolutely. And I've obviously, before this meeting here, I've done some research on the 100th, the 442nd, but Go for Broke. And there's a lot of diversity in the leadership of Go for Broke. You've got some big names as well that are supporting Go for Broke, like Chrissy Yamaguchi, which I think is absolutely incredible. You've got some amazing Japanese Americans on the board for Go for Broke, and they're doing things for Go for Broke, National Education Center, but they're also doing things outside of. But what it shows me is that they have not allowed the hate and the negative history to put them down. They're doing their own things, but they're coming together, and it's this huge coalition of powerhouses, really, that are not only supporting the military aspect of what Go for Broke stands for, but supporting just your average Japanese American citizen outside of the uniform. And it persists. Here we are in 2024. It persists today, and that's just really great to see.
As you mentioned, in our board and leadership, we have a number of non-Japanese Americans too.
You
Junior
do.
Bryant, who used to play for the San Francisco 49ers. We have our board chair is a white American named George Henning. They understand that this is not just a Japanese American story, but it truly is an American story. The very best that our nation has to offer. And that's what I think we as Americans need to continue to tell these stories and share these stories and share the aspiration that our nation can live up to the goals and the dreams and the values that we hold so dearly.
It's awesome. But it all stemmed from the terror that occurred on December 7th, many, many years ago, and the signing of Executive Order 9066. So moving into the 100th and the 442nd, this executive order gets signed. Where are we at as a Japanese American, seeing that the president that maybe you voted for has now, I'm not going to say doomed, but at least subjected your family to internment camps, to second-class citizenship?
Right. It really was a slap in the face. It really was pulling the rug out from underneath the Japanese American community, who saw themselves as being American, right? Mm. And to give you one very specific example, in Hawaii, there were a good number of Japanese American young men who were in the Hawaii Territorial Guard, who the day after Pearl Harbor were on the beaches ready to protect their homes against the invasion from the Japanese. You know, and they saw themselves as good Americans, and even more so, good American soldiers ready to fight and die for the nation. Well, shortly after Pearl Harbor, they are deemed, ineligible to serve, and they literally have their guns taken away from them, and they are sidelined from military service for almost a year until they are eventually formed into the 100th Battalion. And that's why we always mention the 100th, 442nd. The 100th Battalion came first. They were a separate battalion made up primarily of these young men from Hawaii, from the Hawaii Territorial Guard. And they actually went off to Europe before the 442nd did, and saw combat for several months before the 442nd joined them. Mm. And they took tremendous casualties and were oftentimes used as cannon fodder. But they also earned a reputation and were known as the Little Iron Men, and that they would continue to carry out whatever missions they were given, and eventually had success. And clearly, it's not an understatement to say that had the 100th not been successful militarily in carrying out their missions, there would have been no 442nd. The 100th mm-hmm. was a precursor. And then once the 442nd was created, the 100th became the first battalion of the 442nd. But that's why, and your listeners may be a little confused why I always refer to them as the 100th 442nd. It's to pay homage to those that went first, and who really, the soldiers, their shoulders are what the rest of the unit was able to stand on. But to go back to your point, Michael, of on the continent to be incarcerated, to lose your home, your community, your job, to lose your place at the table of citizenship that you thought was yours by birthright, right? Really rattled the Japanese American community. In Hawaii, the community was not incarcerated en masse. They were subject to curfews, they were subject to dislocation at times, and they were certainly subject to a lot of racism and discriminatory treatment, but not to the degree that it occurred on the continent. And one of the reasons for that was economics. That on the continent, Japanese Americans had taken over a lot of infertile land and worked that land and turned it into very fertile farmland. And so part of the motivation incarcerating Japanese Americans, beyond the politics, beyond the wartime fear, was also, if we get them off the land, we can take over their farms. And so many Japanese American families lost their farms or the access to the farmlands that they were working on. In Hawaii, it was a very different story. 40% of the workforce in Hawaii on the plantations and so forth were Japanese American. So if you incarcerated all Japanese Americans, and there was some talk about taking Japanese Americans and either putting them on a separate island or somehow segregating them, the economy of Hawaii would have shut down overnight as the workforce would have been lost. So economics played a very interesting role in why it happened on the continent, but it didn't happen in Hawaii where we had been attacked, right? If a purely military perspective, you would think, well, we were attacked there. That's where we got to shore things up. But just the opposite occurred. And so Japanese Americans were rounded up and they were first sent off to assembly centers, quote unquote assembly centers, which were really oftentimes race tracks, horse racing tracks, and people were housed in stables where livestock, namely horses, had been kept only weeks before. And, you know, for those of you who have been on farms, you know, you don't just wash down a horse stable and it comes out smelling fresh.
Right.
So for months, literally, families were incarcerated in places like Puyallup Fairgrounds, Tanforan Fairgrounds, Santa Anita Racetrack here in the Southern California area, and then eventually sent off to one of these camps that were scattered across the United States. And these camps were in the most desolate areas, oftentimes in the middle of deserts or in swamplands. Oftentimes they were surrounded by barbed wire and machine gun towers, not with the machine guns pointed outward to protect the Japanese Americans, but pointed inward to, you know, ensure that Japanese Americans cooperated.
That's absolutely wild. So you have these Japanese Americans, some that are serving, some that have been forced into camps. And I'm going to go back and highlight it before I ask a question. They felt that they were American citizens. Before they were Japanese, they were American citizens.
Yes.
What were their views on Pearl Harbor? How did they feel about the attack outside of the how they were seen afterward? It's an attack on their own homeland. It, regardless of race or any of that, my homeland's been attacked, but now I'm being attacked by my own homeland. How did they feel about December 7th?
Well, I think your question kind of points to it was a difficult situation. You know, difficult is an understatement. Nearly, in the end, over 120,000 individuals of Japanese ancestry were incarcerated. To me, that means that there were 120,000 stories of how people reacted, right? And of course, it's different for every individual. Mm-hmm. For the Nisei, the second generation, the ones that would become soldiers, right? For them, oftentimes there was anger, there was frustration for all the points that you just mentioned. You know, it's like, America is my country. How dare another country come and attack it, even if it is the land of my father? You know, most Japanese Americans at that point, the Nisei, the second generation, had never been to Japan. Some of them had, but most of them were, you know, American born, American raised, living here, trying to eke out a living. It's not like, you know, they could go back and forth to Japan and so forth. So many of them had never been to Japan. It wasn't this connection that people think they might have had. Now, for their parents who had come from Japan, it might have been a slightly different story because their parents were older. Their parents grew up in Japan. Their parents had spent now the last 30, 40, some even 50 years laying down roots in America, you know, so that they were American by practice and tradition and loyalty.
There's a lot of investment there.
Yes, yes. And so some people will ask, well, if they were so loyal, why didn't they naturalize? Why didn't, you know, my grandparents naturalize? And the answer was simple, because they were prohibited from naturalizing. Japanese at that time in the 1940s, and this didn't change until 1952, were considered aliens ineligible to citizenship.
Yes.
They could not naturalize by law. And I think the best way that I once heard one of the immigrant generation share with me about how they felt at the time was, when your mother and father fight, you don't care who wins as long as the fighting stops, you know? And that was, I think, the feeling for some of the older Japanese Americans, is that, of course, Japan was the land of their birth, but America was now the land that was home and where they were raising their family. and the two were warring, that's not good.
Right? No, no.
Like when mom and dad fight, you just don't want it to end. You just don't want that fighting to continue. There were some Japanese in America who chose to go back to Japan. You know, it's what we called, they repatriated to Japan, but that was such a small percentage, a very small percentage. I don't know the exact figure, but again, very small. And the vast, vast, vast majority stayed in America. Yeah, the other thing that I think your viewers, your listeners need to be aware of is that there were no charges against Japanese Americans. And there were no one was ever convicted of espionage or sabotage or acts against the country. So it's not as, there was a lot of hysteria at the time. The other truth is that most non-Japanese Americans, in particular white Americans, black Americans at that time, throughout the United States, didn't know Japanese Americans. Japanese Americans lived primarily on the West Coast and in Hawaii. So if you're from Missouri, if you're from Oklahoma, if you're from Arkansas, you probably had never met a Japanese American, you know, let alone gotten to know them. But I think the example that I shared about Idaho and Ed Nakamura, who went there, became a basketball player, befriended other white Americans, you know, once they got to know Japanese Americans, they saw them for who they were, fellow Americans.
And then, so Ed Nakamura ends up drafted, or at least in service. Yeah. And we have the activation of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. What did that look like? When it happened, we get this presidential order. This is going to happen. It's a segregated unit. And now we have Japanese Americans who you don't trust fighting for your beliefs, your freedoms, your vision, your way of life.
Right.
What was the response, and how did the 442nd feel?
Well, so keep in mind, the 100th is already in Italy, fighting at that time. And here's an interesting part of the story that oftentimes isn't told, is that the boys from Hawaii are very different than the boys from the continent.
Sure.
Even though they're Japanese American, right? The boys, and if any of your listeners have ever been to Hawaii or know people from Hawaii, it's very a different experience than being from the continent. Guys from Hawaii, they had grown up in a very multicultural environment. They didn't see themselves as minorities in the same way that the Japanese Americans from the continent did, because they, from the continent, they were a vast, vast minority. Furthermore, the guys from Hawaii, they speak their pidgin English. They're very gregarious. They're very outgoing, and by and large. And their style is different. And one example is when you go to the bar, I'll treat everybody. And then next time you treat everybody. You know, it still works out the same, right? Mm. Versus the guys from the mainland, they go to the bar and it's like, I'll buy my beer, you buy your beer kind of thing.
Right.
Cultural differences. And the two groups. And the guys from the mainland speak perfect English, you know.
Sure.
So the guys from Hawaii think, oh, what, you think you're too good for me? And they were fighting all the time. So there's this internal battle. We're literally beefing all the time. And just another side note, the guys from Hawaii, they were referred to as katonks. And katonk is the sound that their head made when it hit the floor after being beaten up. So the Hawaii boys and the mainland boys cannot get along. And it was so bad, Michael, that the Army thought, this experiment's not going to work. These guys can't even get along. How are they going to go fight the Nazis, right? And they tried different ways of getting them to get along, and just nothing really worked until they came up with the idea. They were in Mississippi, in Camp Shelby, several busloads of the Hawaii guys to Arkansas, to the camp in Arkansas. And Senator Danny Noe was one of them. And he tells the story about The Hawaii guys get on the bus. They hear, oh, we're going to go to a camp where there's Japanese Americans and there's going to be women and it's going to be a party. So he says they get onto these buses. They have their cologne on. They have their ukulele. They're singing songs. You know, they're just, these are Hawaii boys. They think they're going to have a good old time, right? They drive for many hours and then they start to approach this military installation. Barbed wire, machine gun towers, and they're looking out the bus window thinking, what is this? You know, what are we going to? They get to the installation, they see white American soldiers with their guns, you know, bayonets on at the gate, and they're scratching their heads. I thought we were going to a camp with Japanese American families. They get in and they see the Japanese American families that are being incarcerated at this camp. And Senator Inouye talked about how for the next day or two, they tried to have a good time. The people at the camp had saved up a week's rations. They threw the best party for them. They did have a dance, and the GIs got to dance with the young women in the camp. And the senator said, you know, we tried to have a good time, but how do you have a good time when you realize that you are amongst your community? And they're in prison. And he said, on the way back, there was no laughing. There was no singing. As each of those Hawaii guys was asking themselves the question, would I serve if they did that to my family? And he said, they got back to Camp Shelby and they spread the word amongst the Hawaii guys. Hey, these guys are the heroes. These guys are the ones who are fighting despite the fact that their family is behind barbed wire. And in that moment, the unit started to gel and the unit came together. And they went to first North Africa, then into Italy, and they immediately began to earn the reputation of being a tremendous fighting unit. And you're right, at first, there's a lot of skepticism.
Sure.
We don't want that unit. Who are these guys? You know, why the hell would we want to take on a unit of the enemy kind of thing, right?
Right, right.
Quickly, they earned the reputation to the point where they were being sent into to situations and being successful where other units had not been. And I'll give you a very specific example. 1944, October. In northern France, the 161st Battalion is a Texas battalion from soldiers, and they're surrounded by Nazi soldiers in the Vosges Mountains. There's about 275 of them surrounded by about 6,000 Nazis. The army tried sending in several battalions to break through, to open up an opening so that they could come out, and none of them had been able to do that. 442nd had just finish a week's worth of fighting in liberating Biefontaine and Bruyères, which are the two neighboring towns. And they were looking for some R&R, forward to some R&R and getting some time to recuperate. But instead, they were sent immediately into the Vosges Mountains to rescue the lost battalion. These men knew that all of them would walk into the forest, but that not all of them would walk out. And in fact, there was an I company that walked in with about 175 men and only 8 walked out.
Jesus.
The 442nd was successful. It broke through the Nazi lines. It rescued 211 white American Texans, but in the process took over 300 casualties. But that was the math of the day. In doing so, they won the respect not only of the generals and the commanding officers, but of the fellow soldiers. And you know, some of the most heartwarming articles that I've read were of other white American soldiers who would talk about these Japanese American soldiers and how they respected them and how most of all they trusted them and they saw them as fellow Americans. You know, the people of Texas were so grateful at that time that the governor of Texas made the members of the 100th 442nd honorary Texans. Back then, the way people got information about what was happening in the war front was that news crews would be at the front lines, you know, filming this, but there was no TV that they could show it on. That people, they would show it at movie theaters, you know, right, in intermission between the double headers or the double features, right? And they created a reel about how the, and they called them Jap Americans saved the Texas Battalion. And they showed footage of these Japanese American soldiers liberating and freeing the Texas soldiers. That's just one example of how they earned the respect. And the 100th 442nd was the only regimental combat team of its size that the Nazis would follow and would make sure they knew where they were. And toward the end of the war, when the 100th 442nd was shipped back to Italy to help break the Gothic line, they were brought to Italy and told not to wear their insignias. They were shipped in the middle of the night because they didn't want the Nazis to know where the unit had been transferred. Because the Nazis referred to them as the Crazy Turks. And I guess they didn't have a word for Japanese, but the Crazy Turks. And
they were afraid of them. That's respect.
They were considered one of the best units of the U.S. Army. You know, one other story to share is that toward the end of the war, as in, and this is in northern France, the army was pushing the Nazis back into Nazi Germany. The 522nd, which was the artillery unit of the 442nd, was broken off, and they were told to be the tip of the spear in chasing the Nazis back into Germany. And so the 522nd, in doing so, is leading the charge as they're, you know, scouting where the Nazis are going and so forth. And one day they stumble upon this large camp, this large installation. They have no idea what it is. So they start approaching it. And as they come to the gates, they see large lumps covered with snow lying on the ground. They think it's logs covered with snow. Until they get up to the lumps and they realize that it's not logs, it's bodies. Bodies of Jewish prisoners, because they had found a satellite of Dachau. They flung open the gates and they found prisoners, Jewish prisoners, inmates, and they rescued them. They liberated them. And then they went on to find more Jewish inmates that had been forced to march back into Germany. But imagine the irony as these young Japanese Americans, some of whom have their own families behind barbed wire in America, liberating Jewish prisoners halfway across the world. There's very few photos of this because the army realized that this would not go over well. They told them no photos until the next day when a white American unit showed up, and then they took the photos.
Of course, yeah.
The satellite. But again, another example of just the contribution that these soldiers made.
It's hard for me to process because I've been stationed in Germany. I've been to Dachau. I remember the barracks. I remember the gas chamber. I remember the pile of shoes. I remember the wrought iron gates. But I've also been stationed in Japan for 3.5 years. And I've been to a lot of the sites there and supervised, but also worked peer-to-peer with Japanese citizens who now hold positions working for the American government. And there's a dichotomy there, which is difficult to wrap your head around. I can't express it, can't explain it, not going to try. It's something you have to experience. The tenacity that the work ethic, the dedication that I have found within the character of both Japanese-born and Japanese-American citizens is unparalleled, in my personal opinion. I haven't been to Japan since 2020, so it's been 4 years now. But I have two very close friends that I stay in contact with, and I've mentioned them on the podcast countless times, Kosho and Shoko both. I can't say enough. And, you know, it's just incredible to me the sacrifices that the Japanese made, not only as Imperial Japanese soldiers, airmen, and Navy fighting for Imperial Japan during World War II, but the Japanese Americans that still brought that same tenacity and character, but felt, I'm American for it. And that is difficult to wrap my head around, because I've seen both sides.
Right. And Michael, we haven't even touched on the Japanese Americans who served in the Pacific. And again, that's a whole story that goes unrecognized. But let me just say this, that they were known as the Military Intelligence Service. And Ed Nakamura, who we talked about, became one of those MIS guys. And many of them, a good number of them, still stayed on after the war in occupied Japan. Tremendous role in translating and interpreting and helping Japan to rebuild itself after the war. A brilliant strategy by the Americans to rebuild your fallen enemy, right? And in fact, the Japanese American soldiers played a critical role in helping to write the Japanese Constitution, which stands to this day. You know, I raise this because I think it demonstrates the brilliance of the American military strategy of the time, but also the contributions of Japanese Americans. Because if you think about it, who is our number one ally in the Pacific right now?
And right. It's Japan. It's Japan.
Hands down. South Korea to a certain extent, but I mean, Japan is the big dog for us in the Pacific. And with all the craziness that is going on in the world, you know, with all the threats that some of the other nations in the Pacific pose to America, it is an incredible story to think about how we were mortal enemies 80 years ago. I mean, you know, the stories that both sides can tell about the death and the destruction and all that kind of stuff. To go from that, mortal enemies, to being each other's strongest ally in that area of the world, you know, is a testament to our nations and also to the role that all of our soldiers played in rebuilding that relationship.
Moving into that, so for my background here, I've got the National Museum of the United States Army, and outside, if you've never been, for anyone, there are these planter boxes basically, and they stand about 4 feet high. And there's these plaques made of, I think they're granite, and they run all along these planter boxes. And I have a photo, and I'll post it, and I'll send it to you personally. These plaques they cost $5,000 a piece, and it's a $5,000 donation to the museum. But I was just there on Thursday this last week, and one stuck out to me, and I took a photo of it. I had to immediately, and it said Nisei Linguist. And it's exactly what you were just talking about.
That's it. Yes.
Yeah. It's exactly that. And it was this military intelligence group that, and it says it on the plaque, how they helped rebuild Japanese diplomacy, Japanese constitution, but in support of American, occupation of Japan following World War II. So here we have this group that was occupied, but even now have spent money to be honored at the National Museum of the United States Army. I had to take a photo of it. I thought of you. I told you saw that book that said "Go for Broke." I will send all that to you. But this group still exists. Their support still exists, and they're at this museum that is in my background right now.
So, and just to be clear, at Go for Broke National Education Center, we tell the story of the 100th 442nd, but also of the MIS, because they were all Japanese Americans. And as I said, Ed Nakamura is still with us. I see him regularly. And, you know, he was one of those that served during and after the war. And again, we can talk more about this at another time, too, that they did more than just translate and transcribe and interpret. I mean, these guys were in the front line of some of the fiercest battles in the Pacific, crawling into caves to talk the Japanese imperial soldiers to surrender, to rescue citizens that were being held hostage by the Japanese soldiers. I mean, some incredible, incredible stories.
We look at all that, fighting your own, but feeling removed from, but being dismissed by what you consider your own. So you're in this weird space. And then it doesn't happen until 1988, where you have the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, well after World War II, well after these internment camps, all the sacrifices made by the 100th and the 442nd. Why in 1988? What took so long and what came of it?
Well, Michael, we really are going to need to have another 5-hour session.
Yeah, no kidding.
But in a nutshell, you're right. It, you know, it took 40 plus years after the end of World War II for our nation to come to a point where they could look back and say what we did was wrong. And, you know, the title of the book that I had the good fortune of being a part of was called Achieving the Impossible Dream, because the idea that our nation would look back and apologize for something it had done during World War II was just considered this impossible dream, that it would never happen. But through the work of Japanese American activists and then supporters from all parts of the United States. I mean, we didn't do this alone. We had people from all walks of life, from all ethnic backgrounds, from all religious backgrounds, who were willing to take a look at the past and say what we did was wrong. Help us and support us and get this bill to the U.S. Congress in 1987. And so in 1987, a bill that asked for a presidential apology and monetary redress payments of $20,000 per individual and the creation of a $50 million trust fund. $20,000 may sound like a lot to some people, but it was really a pittance compared to what was lost. It was symbolic. And our nation had never apologized to anyone at that time. So it really was this impossible dream. It gets to the House on September 17th, 1987, and it passes. 243 representatives vote for this bill. 180 of them are Democrat, 63 of them are Republican. It truly was a bipartisan effort. Newt Gingrich, Dick Cheney, Henry Hyde voted for this bill.
My goodness.
They understood that this was not a special interest bill. They understood this was not an ethnic specific bill, that this was about the Constitution and it was about American constitutional rights that had been denied to Americans. 7 months later, it goes to the Senate, and in the Senate, it passes. And we knew it would pass because Senator Matsunaga was a member of the 100th, 442nd. He had spoken to every senator, lobbied all 99 other senators. And when we went to the Senate floor, he had 71 co-sponsors. So it was a slam dunk. So now we only needed one more supporter, one more signature, one more person to say, yes, let's make that the law. And that, of course, was the president of the United States, right? And in 1988, the president was none other than Ronald Reagan, a very conservative president. And many of us, and I have to admit, myself included, thought there's no way Ronald Reagan is going to sign this bill because it just felt too progressive for his conservative ideology, right? But the folks in the redress movement said, no, we got to keep pushing on. We're going to fight this until he says no, right? And the thing about Ronald Reagan, whether you agreed with his policies or whether you didn't, most people would agree that Ronald Reagan was a great communicator. He had the ability to tell stories that would touch people's hearts and move them in a certain direction. The opposite was true of Ronald Reagan. If you could tell him a story that would touch his heart, you could have a great advocate on your hand. So the question was, what story could we tell Ronald Reagan that would personalize it for him, that would make him feel why this bill was so important. Well, there was a soldier, a member of the 100th 442nd, named Kazuo Masuda. And Kazuo Masuda's family was incarcerated in Gila River, Arizona. And somebody asked him, why are you doing this? Why are you fighting for America while they are imprisoning your family? And his response, I think, is the response that all of the soldiers would have given, which was, because this is the only way I know that my family can have a chance in America. Right or wrong, he understood that loyalty needed to be demonstrated in blood. 2 weeks after saying that, Kazuo Masuda was killed in battle, fighting in Italy for the United States Army with the 100th 442nd. After the war, his family is released from camp, and they go back to Santa Ana, California, to try and reestablish their lives, and they're met with nothing but hate speech, racial taunts, and threats of bodily harm. And the Army realizes that this is a PR fiasco, that one of its own fallen heroes, his family can't move back home. So they send out a contingent of Army officers to have a medal ceremony for the Masuda family. He was given the Distinguished Service Cross for his service. And they went to Santa Ana, California, and during the day, they had a medal ceremony where they presented the Distinguished Service Cross to his sister. That night, at a rally, there was a white American captain named Ronald Reagan to the audience. And on that day, Captain Reagan said, "The blood that is soaked into the sands of a beach is all of one color. America stands unique in the world, the only country not founded on race, but on an ideal, on a way. Mr. and Mrs. Masuda, as one member of the American family to another, for what your son Kazuo did, thanks." That story was relayed to President Reagan in the mid-80s. And his response was, "I remember what those soldiers did for America." It wasn't the only reason he signed. It helped to align the issue with his personal vision of what America should be and his political vision of what America should be. And so on August 10th, 1988, President Reagan did sign the Civil Liberties Act, giving an apology and monetary redress to those affected by EO 9066. Kazuo Masuda's words were very prophetic, that he was making America a better place and giving his family a chance in America.
Amazing story. And I remember discussing some of that with you prior to the recording. And no matter how many times you hear that, it lands every time. And I can't think of a better way to close things out, honestly. So what I do want to say is a couple things. Number one, thank you, Dr. Maki, for being a guest on the podcast.
Michael, first of all, drop the Dr. Maki. It's Mitt.
Okay, Mitch it is. All right. Well, thank you, Mitch, for the conversation. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for everything you represent, for the work that you're doing and that the Go for Broke National Education Center is doing.
Michael, next time you are in LA,
yes,
you have definitely got to reach out. We have got to meet in person.
I would love that.
And when I get out to your way, I definitely will reach out. But and please, I would be more than happy if you have a panel or whatever, or you want me to come back and talk about the MIS or whatever.
Sure.
Happy to be back.
That would be great. Thank you so much. The MIS, I think, would make, not everybody knows about it. I think it's understudied. I think it's underappreciated. So I will be reaching out, let Jamie know.
Okay.
It's coming. So a couple things, just closing notes. The Go for Broke National Education Center has an extensive website, which I've spent a lot of time on. I'm going to post that link in the show notes. You can visit the site and check out their exhibitions, their programs, upcoming events. And you can also learn about the 100th, the 442nd. And you can also find ways to support Go for Broke, as well as plan a visit to Go for Broke, all on their website. So that's something I highly recommend that everyone checks out. Also available in the show notes is a link to the Amazon purchase site, if you will, for Dr. Maki's book, Achieving the Impossible Dream, How Japanese Americans Obtained Redress. So that's available on Amazon. It's got really great ratings, by the way. I don't know if you've seen that. It's got great reviews, great ratings. So that's something to look out for. Real quick, is there anything that you want to say about Go for Broke, future projects, or anything that people should look out for before we close out this episode of Hard Tack?
Two things very quickly. Go to our YouTube channel. We have created a number of videos that tell some of the stories that I refer to here, as well as we've created videos about Black American soldiers during World War II and their courage, patriotism, awesome. Service. So there are some fun videos to take a look at. And finally, please follow us on our website. And as we build our new building, I think it is a testament to the veterans and how their service continues in our nation today.
Awesome. All right. So Mitch here is going to provide me with that YouTube. I will include all the links possible, resources in the show notes, and then I'll post them on all of the Hard Tack socials as well as our website. So look out for that. Moving forward, our next topic for Hard Tack is going to be something that I teased in an earlier episode, Yellow Journalism, American Propaganda and Overseas Expansion. Huge topic, a little political, but we're going to go there. Outside of that, I'm not going to say anything else. Don't forget to leave a review, subscribe on whichever platform you use to consume your Hard Tack. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. And remember to keep your Hard Tack dry.